You're listening to All Things Considered on North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Jeff Tabiri. Time again to try to make some sense of the week in state politics. Here for our discussion is Chris Fitzsimon, sitting in for Rob Schofield. Chris is the founder and executive director of the liberal NC Policy Watch. And here, as usual, is Becky Gray of the conservative John Locke Foundation. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
On Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court affirmed a lower court ruling striking down 28 legislative districts for being illegally racially gerrymandered. On Wednesday, Governor Roy Cooper called lawmakers into a special session, pressuring them to draw new maps quickly and keep alive the possibility of special elections later this year. Then, on Thursday, lawmakers voted not to go into a special session, questioning Cooper's authority and saying that they reject all of this as a political stunt. Becky, nice to see everyone getting along so well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The court has ruled. Why don't they just come in and draw these maps?
Well, the court did rule that the districts are racially gerrymandered. However, the courts also said that there was not a compelling reason to do this in 2017. Basically, the clock is running out on 2017. So there is not a demand to redraw these districts. Everybody had thought we would do this in 2018 for the 2018 election. But interesting things happening this week, again, reliance on the North Carolina Constitution. I mean, that's basically what the General Assembly said is, under the Constitution, the governor did not act in compliance with the Constitution. Both the state and the Senate just pretty much said, we're out of here.
Chris, governor says he is in compliance with the Constitution and that this is an unconstitutional legislature for the last 5 years. Is it time to come back and draw these maps?
I did find some irony in the fact that we had a legislature who drew racially gerrymandered unconstitutional districts. According to the unanimous decision of a Republican Supreme Court, even Neil Gorsuch, President Trump's nominee, participated. So these districts are clearly unconstitutional. They have been for 5.5 years. And then Governor Cooper, I think what he's trying to do is get the districts drawn as soon as possible. You know, the court didn't say you can't have an election in 2017. It said the 4th District didn't examine that carefully enough and what all the repercussions were, and it left it up to the federal 3-judge panel to come up with a remedy, which could include elections in 2017. It's also worth remembering when Republicans earlier in 2002, a Republican lawyer who's still involved in redistricting cases said, it's paramount as soon as we can to fix the irreparable harm to voters who have not had their constitutional rights allowed to them under these gerrymandered districts, and we need to do that as soon as possible. The other quick thing I would add is I was a little surprised that the General Assembly said it was unconstitutional for the governor to call them back in. I think it's clearly in the Constitution he can call a special session. They don't have to do what he says. They could have had the session and then adjourn and say, we're not going to do it. The argument was he didn't consult with the Council of State, but I'm pretty sure Governor McCrory didn't poll the Council of State before he called him in for HB 2.
2017 versus 2018 elections. Would like to hear from each of you in brief. One thought for me is that if special elections were to take place this year, and let's be clear, the window is barely open, barely ajar on this, seems as though it would be a benefit for conservatives and Republicans. Does the left have enough candidates, enough money? History is on your side if you wait till 2018 in the midterms.
Yeah, although I think there are people who really believe it's not about just about politics, that we've had these people illegally elected, in effect, for a long time. I don't know what the politics of it would be, but I do think that we had elections we had primary elections in September one time and the general election in November. That would be a stretch. I think it's unlikely we're going to have elections in 2017, but I don't understand the hesitation in drawing the districts. The districts clearly have to be drawn. The earlier they're drawn, people can decide if they want to run. They can learn about the districts. I think it's in everybody's best interest to draw them immediately. I was disappointed the General Assembly not only didn't come into special session, just went home and said, oh, we may deal with it next week.
I don't entirely disagree with everything Chris has said. I think clearly the districts are going to have to be redrawn. I'd rather see them take a little bit of time, have some public hearings, allow enough time that there's public input and that it's done right. Jeff, to your question as to who has the advantage of when this is done, to be honest with you, I hope that's not part of the consideration. I mean, realistically, I understand, you know, we deal with a political body with the General Assembly, but I think the part of this whole question is how do we enfranchise, not disenfranchise, how do we get more people involved and fairer elections and making those decisions based on where the political advantage of that seems to me counterintuitive to exactly what we're trying to do.
Okay, if I can jump in for one quick second, one of the other things we haven't talked about yet is that this actually have an impact on the rest of the session. Redistricting is the most political act inside the General Assembly, and I know there are reports that some Republicans, very conservative Republicans, want to see the new districts before they vote on the final budget, for example. So redistricting now is thrown into this volatile mix of the budget, of the gun bill, of everything that happens. Until those districts are drawn, every legislator knows their districts and their political lives really are at stake.
And that's on both sides of the aisle.
That's on both sides, that's right. Yeah.
And it's a wild card. We can
Absolutely.
Agree with that.
Absolutely. But Jeff, one thing too, I think on this question of are we going to redraw the districts for a 2017 election, let's back up from that a little bit and just think there may be a possibility the new districts, if you make the argument that these have to be drawn before the 2018 election, that would be in November of 2018, do they need new districts in place for the short session? If they do they have to be drawn before November? Could they draw the maps, let's say, in February and have an election in March for the May short session? So, I mean, there's still a lot of unanswered questions out there.
Right. Well, just to immediately respond to that, that seems pretty problematic to me in terms of a timeline, in terms of overseas
all
ballots
of it.
And
there are problems with all
and,
of it.
Right,
mm-hmm.
right. But that,
yeah, there are challenges.
To push it back to next winter seems like it creates some more timing challenges.
Absolutely some questions, but I think that's kind of the point of this whole discussion. There are lots of questions out there, but I think, and I think Chris and I would agree, that the primary question is how do we ensure that North Carolina voters have confidence in the elections and how does our representative government best work?
Also this week, a gun bill moved through the legislature. Under this proposal, residents would no longer have to have a concealed handgun permit to bring a gun where firearms can already be carried openly. In other words, this eliminates concealed carry permits for adults who are 18 rather than the current statute of 21 and those folks who are not prohibited from owning guns. Chris, why, in your opinion, is this a bad bill?
Well, I think it's a bad bill because we've had a state policy for a long time, and I would quote the conservatives who are now supporting this, who always said, don't worry if people have, and when we say concealed carry, I think it's important to know what that means is a loaded hidden handgun out of sight, in a purse, in your pants, in your pocket. The legislature has always assured us that it's okay if people have those hidden guns because they've been through safety training, because the sheriff has looked at their mental health records, if there are any, has done his own, he or she has done their own background checks. Now all of a sudden we're told we don't need to do that. And that we'll literally have 18-year-olds who maybe they've had a gun before, but now they can have a concealed carry or have a concealed gun with them wherever they go virtually. And I think it doesn't make sense to do this ever, but it certainly doesn't make sense to do this in this hyper environment that we're in. I think it's a big mistake, and I was disappointed, frankly, that the House leadership didn't allow on second reading cutoff debate, which they don't do very often. They did that. They didn't allow a lot of amendments to be discussed. I think if we're changing policy about firearms and life and death, we need to be a little bit more open and transparent about it.
Jeff, I just would like to have seen a little bit more debate, consideration of it. I'm a big believer in the Second Amendment and protecting those Second Amendment rights. Personally, I have a little bit of a concern with broadening the ability for 18-year-olds, 18, 19, 20-year-olds to have firearms. I don't know a lot about this, to be honest with you. I'm not a gun owner. I'm not a gun. I mean, again, I firmly believe in the Second Amendment for those folks who make that choice. But a lot of these, I tend to listen to the law enforcement community and what their feelings on this are, and they have been pretty adamant that they are opposed to this. So for that reason alone, I would like to have slowed this down, heard a little bit more debate, perhaps some amendments, some more input for me to feel comfortable with it, to have more input from the law enforcement community.
And it's worth noting that the bill did pass second and third reading, but neither
Very
time
slim
with a
margin.
Neither time had a veto-proof majority.
Right.
So Governor Cooper really will have a say, I think, in what the final outcome of this.
If it gets through the Senate.
That's right.
If the Senate decides
the Senate.
To take it up.
You're ahead of me, which is no surprise. Does this even get through the Senate?
I don't know. I mean, you know, you hear different rumors. It's very controversial. Again, as Chris pointed out, there is not a veto-proof vote, at least on this one. I think it's kind of risky. If the Senate were going to take it up, my recommendation would be let's take some time. Let's listen to all factions here. Let's make sure we get it right.
Well, there might be support for the Second Amendment, widespread support in both chambers from the Republican caucus. I would venture to say there's more enthusiasm from the House Republican caucus than the Senate Republican caucus. Is that fair?
Get that sense, being at the building,
and
listening to the debate.
And in the previous sessions, the champion sort of for gun legislation was Tom Goolsbee, who's no longer there, who's now on the UNC Board of Governors. He sort of was the leading proponent of pro-gun bills and carried the NRA bills and so forth. He's not there, so I'm not sure. I'm sure there are people who support this, but it's not as obvious. I think you're probably right. The enthusiasm might not be there.
Interestingly enough, the other thing that happened this week is there's a constitutional amendment proposal out of the Senate to make a constitutional provision that would say that we have a right to hunt and fish in North Carolina. Of course, that involves guns. So I think sort of this getting it right, looking at it of what protects our Second Amendment, what protects, what makes North Carolina great. And for many North Carolinians, that means hunting and fishing and wildlife, those kind of things. Let's just make sure we get it right.
Tom Goolsbee, not in the building in an official lawmaking capacity, but was outside the House chamber on Wednesday when this gun bill was being debated for a while during the afternoon. Just an interesting note there. Meanwhile, an energy bill flew through the House this week. It loosened some restrictions on citizens' access to solar, yet at the same time, critics say it gives Duke Energy too much control. Becky, why should people care about this?
Well, this is one of those interesting ones. This is one of those stakeholder bills that a group of individuals, dozens of individuals with interest in this, have been meeting for close to a year, cobbled this together, then presented it to the legislature and said, this is something we agree on, pass it. If you take anything out, the whole thing will fall apart. This has real, you know, sort of the nightmare of Senate Bill 3 in 2007. We're still going through it, trying to determine whether there, how much good stuff is in there, how much bad stuff is in there. I think there are some good things in that it rolls back some of the PURPA requirements, contract without getting too much in the weeds, for energy contracts that estimates that we could save $1 billion in energy cost over the next 10 years. I think that's significant. I think something we clearly need to talk about, think about. How much subsidies the solar industry needs to continue to get is something I think we really need to pay attention to. Many people are saying the solar industry gets too much subsidy, too much special tax credit and treatments in this bill. Some people say it's not enough. I'd like to see, again, I'd like to see in the Senate, I'd like to see that slow down. I'd like to see those of us who aren't energy engineers really be able to understand this, because it's going to impact every North Carolina family.
I think it's very complicated. I understand the stakeholder process, but there's also the public process, and I wish the House had had long, open committee hearings and had some testimony in public. There were, for example, Representative Pricey Harrison might be the leading environmentalist legislator. She just saw it when it came on the House floor, or saw it in the committee, and it was rushed through, I think, very quickly, and I hope that the Senate will be much more deliberate. I do think it's good that it sort of reaffirms the state's commitment to renewable energy. It changes, for example, tax credits to rebates. It does allow consumers to buy solar power from third parties. And we can do, and it affects you if you have solar panels on your house. It is very complicated. It has also has the unusual characteristic of having Americans for Prosperity and the Sustainable Energy Association supporting it, which you wouldn't think you'd see those kind of bedfellows there. I think they were both at the table when this was developed. But I actually do agree with Becky. I think there's a lot of good in it. There's some things that trouble me and trouble us. On the progressive side, what I hope we'll do is that the Senate will take its time, we'll open up this process. It'll be a long process, and this is one of those that might be so complicated it could even go into next year's short session when there's plenty of time to examine this. We certainly don't need to rush this through the Senate.
Chris Fitzsimon is founder and executive director of NC Policy Watch, part of the North Carolina Justice Center. Becky Gray is a lobbyist and senior vice president at the John Locke Foundation. Thank you both.
Thanks, Jeff.
Hear more of our conversation at WUNC.org. This segment was recorded at our studios in the Natural Sciences Museum in downtown Raleigh.